Welcome to Local Talk concerning our COVID-19 response on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore the people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. Good to get together again to provide facts to our community through technology and word of mouth. Thank you for listening. I'm Pat Schlarbaum, your host for this hour, with Anna Banana Magnuson with her heart-to-heart messages from KHOI, because we are the heart of Iowa. Hi, Anna.
Hi, I can't wait to hear the show.
Well, here we go. The weather, what did you think of the weather yesterday? But today, more low clouds and chilly, possible showers. With a high of 45, we'll hopefully avoid the snow like yesterday. It just seems so rude to deal with snow. Although it was interesting knowing Matt Michaels was out on his cross-country skis in October. But now let's welcome Teresa Greenfield, our Senate candidate for the U.S. Senate. Hello, Ms. Greenfield.
Hello, and good morning, everyone. It's great to be here, even if it is kind of snowy outside.
Yeah, yeah, it's okay. We're going to survive this. We'll get through this. It'll be back to an Indian summer one of these days, hopefully.
You bet.
So we're all familiar with your name. Is there anything in your background you'd like to share with us and experiences leading up to your candidacy?
Yeah, Pat, thanks so much. You know, I think it's just love to introduce myself to your listeners this morning. I'm a businesswoman. I've spent most of my career working in small businesses, really small. Some of them running bean walking crews back on the farm when I was a kid, but also working my way up to being the president of a small family-owned commercial real estate company. We had 8 employees, and I'll tell you, they become like family. I think that's typical in Iowa. You know, Iowa's a real small towns and small businesses. I'm a mother of 4, delighted to be an empty nester mother of 4. And our little squirt, he serves in the United States Army. And of course, I'm grateful for everyone that serves. And I'm a farm kid. I grew up outside a little town of 500. And one of the things I'm pretty proud of is certainly I learned to make things and fix things on the farm. Love that. But my dad always said, there's no boy jobs and there's no girl jobs. There's just jobs that need to get done. And that has been sort of a motto and a work ethic I've taken with me all my life. And I agree, in Washington right now, we've got a lot of jobs that need to get done. And so I got in this race to put Iowa first, and I'll work with anyone to get those jobs done.
Those are really wonderful qualifications. Are there any other elected offices that you've held?
Well, Pat, you know what? I have not been elected to office. I decided to get off the sidelines because there's so much work to do. And certainly as I've crisscrossed the state and done well over 300 campaign events, people are talking about the issues they care about, you know, healthcare, COVID, both the health tragedy and the economic crisis, infrastructure. But one of the things that unites us, honestly, is people want the divisiveness to end. They want leaders that are going to come together. They don't care if it's a Republican idea or a Democratic idea, a leader that's going to come together to get work done. I've done this all my life. I worked about the first 14 years of my career as a community planner with neighborhood groups and planning commissions and city councils and town boards. And you learn pretty quickly, you know, that a pothole in the middle of the street, it's not a Republican problem or a Democratic problem. It's a problem we need to solve. And so it drove me to get in this race and to really fight to put Iowans first and to solve and work on issues that we need to tackle.
Well, it sounds like you have a fresh approach to some of our, as you say, our longstanding challenges that we're all facing with. So Iowa, an agricultural community with a lot of special places. By that, I'm referring to our rivers and our agricultural landscape. The rivers really provide corridors for our wildlife. How do you feel the environment fits into the big picture of the Iowa landscape?
Well, Pat, I have a saying, it goes like this. If you've been to one small town, you've been to one small town. And to your point, Iowa is so unique and there are so many beautiful places and interesting geography, and particularly our rivers. you know, I would just encourage everyone to go to my website and look at my Fair Shot for Farmers plan. One of the things I talk about in there include, you know, trade and competition and investing in rural opportunity, but also conservation. Pat, I want to make sure that conservation becomes a next commodity for our farmers and our landowners as we work to make sure that the United States becomes the first net zero ag industry in the world. That conservation, it'll be an opportunity to sequester carbon. It'll be an opportunity to improve our soil health. It'll be an opportunity to take advantage of many of these natural resources and wildlife corridors. But it also needs to be done with farmers at the table, leading the way, and it has to be an economic driver for them and a benefit for all of us. So I am excited about rolling up my sleeves and growing our ag industry and emphasizing and investing in conservation.
Yes, the recent bailouts are somewhat concerning in that we seem to be moving forward with production at levels that seem to be taxing our systems, if you will. Am I correct? Was there a $12 billion subsidy to agriculture and then followed up with another $16 billion? And have there been improvements? We seem to be just kind of getting by with those astronomical numbers. How does the breakdown for an individual that is meeting with the Iowa, what are you hearing on this approach to making through these subsidies?
Well, Pat, I'll tell you, whether I'm in Fayette County or O'Brien County or down in Guthrie County, it doesn't matter. Farmers want their markets back. They want to compete. And unfortunately, haphazard trade, reckless tariffs, an abuse of our Section 232 tariffs, the Senator Ernst 85 ethanol waivers, they've been devastating to the farm economy. But that's not what farmers want. They absolutely want to compete. And it has to be a priority to end this go-it-alone approach. Of course, China's been a bad actor, and we've got to hold them accountable, and I will. But they've been a bad actor around the globe, and we need to work together with our partners to help rebuild our markets and rebuild a strong economy. Look, net farm income is down 75% since 2013. Bankruptcy rates are at an eight-year high. And that kind of struggle, well, I remember that kind of struggle. I grew up in the farm crisis when interest rates were 21%. I went to auctions where the contents of a family's home was put in cardboard boxes, out on hay racks, auctioned off for a few bucks, and folks left our communities. My parents struggled too. They had to sell their crop dusting business. They had to sell their hogs. They never farmed again. And us five kids all ended up leaving the rural area. So the decisions that get made in Washington, they affect our lives and our farmers and our ag economy here in rural states like Iowa. We can make better decisions. And it's part of the reason I got in this race.
And I certainly appreciated this technology to be able to be included. Kind of missed the one-on-one from across the table. But I guess the Zoom technology, we've adapted to something that, gosh, did any of us see anything like this coming a year ago with the COVID-19?
Well, I think you're right, Pat. I think that campaigning a year ago was very different than it is today, but it's still the same. You know, again, we've done well over 300 campaign events all over the state, talking to Iowans in all 99 counties. Most importantly, listening, learning, so we can lead. And we're going to continue to travel. I've already had to put another set of tires on my truck. But we also know many, many Iowans are staying home. And so we're connecting by teletown hall meetings. We're connecting by Zoom meetings, Facebook Lives, and of course, like we're doing today, reaching out through the radio. So we're going to continue to campaign hard, virtually and in person, right up until those polls close on November 3rd.
I guess drilling a little more succinctly into the healthcare issues? Are there things that you would like to see occur to help us kind of stem this, the tide of this current pandemic?
Well, I think that this pandemic is going to be one of the most consequential events of my lifetime, the healthcare tragedy, the economic crisis. And Washington has failed us, and Senator Joni Ernst has failed us also. I have put out my Back on Our Feet plan and have been calling for a robust phase four stimulus package for months and months and months. And for me, I think we need to focus on three buckets of support. One, focusing on health and safety for all of us, investing in testing and tracing and PPE, emergency temporary standards, a statewide mask mandate. The White House Task Force recommends that Iowa have a statewide mask mandate. We need to do that. Second bucket, focusing on our workers, you know, with unemployment rates, you know, so high. We have got a lot of hardworking folks out there who need a hand up, and we need to extend those expanded unemployment benefits. We need to take a look at direct payments. We need paid sick leave extended. You know, folks shouldn't have to choose between going to work sick or staying home and taking care of themselves and their family members, but risking losing a paycheck, losing a job, not being able to pay their bills. And then third, our economy. And as I said earlier, Iowa is definitely a state of small towns and small businesses. And every time I'm on the road, I'm meeting with small businesses. I've met with a few in Ames, even stopped by Cornbread maybe a week ago, Luvio Brewing, and talked to them. But across the state, our small businesses are still struggling, and they need another round of PPP. Many of them tell me that their revenues are still down 60%. They want to be able to keep their employees on the job or hire them back. They want to keep their lights on. I met with a gentleman up in Fort Dodge who runs a cleaning business. He does commercial cleaning, commercial buildings. And with so many of those businesses closed and working from home right now, he's afraid he won't even have a business after the first of the year. So it's critical and urgent, and we have to have a phase four stimulus package quickly.
Yeah, and quickly and I guess it is a relative term. We want to put all this behind us, but we still have a ways to go, it would seem. What are some of the other issues that are preeminent in your view of Iowa and what Iowa needs at this time?
Well, as we talk, healthcare is the number one topic, whether it's rural healthcare, whether it's lowering prescription drug costs. You know, seniors are being gouged, mental health care, addiction care. Just being able to afford your premium. So we've got to strengthen and enhance the Affordable Care Act, build in that public option, and require Medicare to negotiate for those prescription drug costs. Senator Joni Ernst, and Iowans need to know this, she has voted repeatedly to end the Affordable Care Act, take away your protections for pre-existing conditions, your coverage for prescriptions and mental health care, and keeping your kids on your health insurance. But even worse yet, to end Medicaid expansion, which has kept hospitals open, kept their lights on. I stopped up at the Boone County Hospital and got a chance to tour and learn about the care they provide, but also sit down at the boardroom table and understand what a role and what a lifeline Medicaid has been to keeping their services open. So healthcare is number one. But Pat, I got to tell you, something I'm disappointed in both parties, Republicans and Democrats, is we haven't gotten an infrastructure package done. So whether it's bridges or broadband or everything in between, we absolutely need to make that investment. And again, I'll work with anyone to get that done. We are 50th in the nation in bridge suitability here in Iowa. That's unacceptable. We need to invest in broadband to make sure that our students are doing their best. Our entrepreneurs are building their small businesses. Our farmers have access to precision farming and everything in between so that we can compete in this economy.
Yeah, in this economy that has trillions in debt, is there a thought process that you're approaching to have some sense on possibly having an administration where the debt load of our future generations won't be quite as extreme as what we're experiencing now? Or am I mistaken? Is our debt that critical of an issue?
Well, Pat, when it comes to our debt, I certainly wouldn't have done what Senator Ernst did, which was vote for a tax bill that increased our debt $2 trillion. and now threatens Social Security and Medicare. And, you know, the vast majority of those benefits went to the largest corporations and the wealthiest in this country. And that's just unacceptable. For me, when it comes to looking at taxes, one, we've got to make sure that the wealthiest and the largest corporations just pay in their fair share. But that I'm not going to vote for any tax policies that further tax our hardworking families, our middle-class families. They're already paying their fair share. And there's lots of things we can do. One, Medicare negotiating for prescription drug costs. I'll tell you what, that'll put some dollars back in our seniors' pockets. They need those costs to come down. And it'll save us as taxpayers about $500 billion. We can end those tax breaks and loopholes that Senator Ernst supports that allows corporations to ship jobs overseas. We need to be growing the economy here and have those jobs right here and buying American products. And then finally, here's one. We should end tax credits to Big Pharma, which allows them to run TV ads. So I know there's lots of work that we can do, and I'm looking forward to being the next junior senator from the state of Iowa.
Well, I certainly like that sense of wrapping up here, but I have one pressing question. It's probably not that important. It is from a human's perspective. What year is your Chevrolet Nova in one of your ads?
That Nova is a 1978 Nova. My first husband, Rod, bought it off the showroom floor. It's never been driven in the snow, and it's probably got about 80,000 miles on it. I love that car. The kids have taken it on their first dates and homecoming football games and to proms. It's an awful lot of fun to drive.
Well, is that along the lines of something that you'd like to share with our listeners this morning that maybe they haven't heard?
You bet. The Nova has been awfully fun part of our family and in a fun way that we continue to honor my first husband and the boys' dad together. And we've had a lot of fun with it. So, yeah, Pat, that's a great story to share.
Is there anything else?
Well, I appreciate the opportunity to introduce myself and just encourage everyone to make a plan to vote. Their vote is their voice. I'm going to be working hard to make it easier to vote, not harder to vote as your next senator. But you can request an absentee ballot. You can show up early. Early voting has started. And, of course, you can vote on Election Day, November 3rd. Just make that plan. And, of course, I'd be honored to earn everyone's vote in this election.
Thank you, Teresa Greenfield, running for the United States Senate in Iowa. Thank you.
Thanks, Pat. Thanks, Anna.
Well, I dreamed I saw the knights in armor come and saying something about a queen. There were peasants singing and drummers drumming and the archers split the tree. There was a fanfare blowing to the sun that was floating on the breeze. Look at Mother Nature on the run in the 1970s. Look at Mother Nature on the run in the 1970s. I was lying in a burned out basement with
and some Neil Young from the back in the 70s after the gold rush. And every Saturday morning, we see a line of early voters at the Ames Public Library in downtown Ames, along with many other election sites around the country. We stopped by the line to listen in on some thoughts of those early voters recently.
2020 has been a year, hasn't it? And I'll be honest that I was a bad U.S. citizen last election and I didn't vote. And I feel like now I need to make sure that my voice is heard. I feel like there's so many important things happening this election and just this year in general that it's very important to vote early.
everyone has their differences in opinion, but we all need to come together as a country, and we just can't be divided. This is a very important year, I think, for everyone to vote truest to their views. With the way the pandemic's been handled and such vitriol coming from our leader, this is a very critical year, I think.
Well, we're really going into a lot of turmoil here with the politicians. You don't know what to believe and who to believe, and it's kind of hard to decipher who's telling the truth and who's not. I'm voting early to make sure my vote counts. Well, I'm very content with who I'm choosing. Yes, very.
I'm here to vote early because it's just incredibly important to make sure my vote gets in, and I don't know what to expect on election day. I am concerned about some of these like patriot groups that might be floating around election areas on the day of that, as well as just I need to be absolutely certain my vote is counted, especially this year more than others, because whoever wins this election is going to direct where our country goes from here. And we're in a very sad space right now. It's filled with hate and division, and I personally feel that Donald Trump is not a proponent of democracy or of people and their rights, and that scares me.
Voting early today because I just want to make sure it happens. Judging by how 2020 has gone so far, it seems like a good idea. I mean, I never imagined there would be a pandemic going on, and you never know what's going to come up or change in the next few weeks. But I was surprised to see the line, but happy at the same time. Yeah, I'm hoping for positive change as always. A couple of years have been a little disturbing to me. Just, you know, the way the pandemic's been handled and the way that things have gone. So I'm ready to see a change.
This year has shown that everybody's voice should count, and we should take advantage of that. It's important to make a stance and at least show your opinion, even when it's hard to do so.
I'm a school bus driver, and I might contract COVID-19 and not be able to vote on November 3rd because I have kids that might come down with it. We have to get checked every day, and if there's any possibility that my temperature is high or have any symptoms, I'm out of work and might not be able to come and do this either. So getting it done now. I just want to make sure. I mean, that's the American thing to do. We have the right to vote. We should exercise that right. So I've been doing it since 1971.
Thank you for that report, Ursula Rudenberg from the Ames Library. At the end of summer, KHOI's newsman Dennis Hart held a lengthy conversation with Jenny Risner, the superintendent of the Ames School Board. Ms. Risner described at that time how they were making preparations for school openings as ordered by the governor. Now with school in session, Dennis Hart checks back to find out from Superintendent Risner how this completely new way of running schools is working out.
Jenny, you began the school year fully online in terms of teaching, and you've gone to the hybrid model for the last month or so. Can you explain for those of us who are not parents in the school district and who are laymen exactly how the hybrid model is working?
Absolutely. So the structure of the hybrid model is such that we have our students who are not in our remote campus. So students who have elected to be back in school in a face-to-face manner, we have those students split into two groups. So we'll give an example. Group one comes to school on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday. And then they are in hybrid mode, which is working virtually on Thursday, Friday. And then the same is true the following week for group two. So group two then comes the next week, 3 days, and they're in hybrid the 2 days. So within a two-week period, all groups of students have come 50% or more. So yeah.
Have the students who are in the hybrid mode, are they actually showing up online for classes when they are online? And how do you know?
So that's one of our most concerning parts of this process is those students who are in hybrid mode, it is becoming more and more difficult to engage with them. And so as time goes on, we are finding that less and less are really showing up on that on those virtual days. And for many reasons, as we've dug into this and talked with parents, for some parents of our younger students, it's a heavy load for them. And so they really, they're struggling to keep up with their own lives and work and, running families. And so those days that students are on hybrid, for parents, it's tough. And then for our older students, it's hard to engage. And so we are, we are finding an increase in the number of students participating that way. And an increase in the number not participating. And so that is something we're really watching and working on, and some things, that we're trying to do when we're not engaging with them the way we want to be. We have teachers tracking that. Then we have teachers reaching out. We have counselors reaching out. We have our social workers reaching out. And then finally, if we're not able to connect, we have principals reaching out, and they're trying to problem solve with families. If there are barriers, we're trying to meet the needs so that we can take care of those barriers. And, in some cases, just to give an example, it might be that there's so many people accessing the internet at one time that the student isn't able to keep up because their computer's freezing or dropping them. We all have those problems. So, it's problem solving through those.
For kids who are in the hybrid mode and are not showing up online, and if you can't reach them, what happens to their grades? What happens to their progress during the school year?
And that's right where we're at right now, because we've now been in school long enough that those students who are not showing up, we know that their academic progress is going to be compromised because of that. So, we have a board meeting on Monday to talk through kind of what the data is showing us, what the data is saying, and how, how we take next steps, whatever those might be, to ensure that we are meeting with our kids.
Do you know what percentage of the students who are scheduled to be online during the hybrid mode are not showing up?
We don't have data yet on that. Our principals are tracking it and working on verifying that data. One of the interesting things has been, how do you take that attendance when they're in remote? And so, one of the thoughts is, if a student checks in, if a student logs in, then they're present. Yet, we don't require all students to have their screens on, because there's some equity issues with that and some privacy things for students, that don't want things in the background going on that their peers can see. And so it's been a struggle in how do you take attendance? So yes, we thought logging on, that shows the kid is there, but then that doesn't necessarily mean the kid stays there or that the kid is engaged. So we are sorting through those things right now on how we come to that place where we can really monitor the level of engagement and attendance.
We've just been talking about the hybrid mode, but you have a significant number of students who have decided to go fully online for this particular period of time. About how many students are involved with that?
Yeah, so we have a total of about 1,600. So it's really, I think our exact number is 1,674. Within that, we have about 700 elementary students. We have about 440 middle school students, and we have about 530 high school students. And so we're really treating that as a campus, because that's as many as some districts. And so within that, we are seeing kids having a lot of success. And so the model is a little different than that hybrid model. And so the frequency that they are, they're in a regular mode of learning all the time, seeing their teacher every day. And that seems to be working for those students that are in that model. And another thing, I guess, that I could say that our principals have been able to identify is that within that model, because of the structure to that, they're progressing a little faster through the curriculum or the standards. And so there's a little bit more lag with the face-to-face because of that hybrid model, even when teachers are introducing new content to students who are in that hybrid virtual mode, they're coming back and having to reteach that a lot. So that is one of the, you know, one of the other concerns is the progress through the curriculum.
So you seem to be saying that the students in fully online mode are attending more frequently than those in the hybrid mode online.
They are. Mm-hmm. Yep, absolutely. Yes.
How is this working out for teachers? Do you have teachers who are teaching both hybrid and fully online, or are there separate teachers doing that?
We sure do. So for the teachers that are in that hybrid model, they also then have responsibility to teach face-to-face and then to teach those students who are on the off days virtually. And that is a big lift. And that's, you know, I met today with superintendents from across the state, and we all are continuing to struggle with that because it's a lot on a teacher. Whereas many of our virtual teachers are strictly virtual. In some cases, we do have, so that would be for the remote campus, they're assigned fully online. We do have our middle school model looks a little differently in that teachers have a period off that they then have a class that's virtual. So they have that time during one period that they're interacting then with those students who are in the remote campus. So, and then the high school is a little different, yet we have a program that we're using for high school students when there isn't a teacher that is teaching directly. And that program does have virtual teachers, but you know, we think our teachers are always better than everywhere else because we have phenomenal teachers. So, you know, we're trying to balance that as well.
How did you choose which teachers would go fully online teaching and those in the hybrid, or were they able to apply for one or the other? How did that work?
Excellent question, and one that we were really, really thoughtful about. Our first priority was to try and meet the needs of our teachers. So if we had teachers that requested accommodations or that needed to be fully virtual, we tried to match them up with virtual assignments. And I was really proud of our district for taking that approach. It was a teacher-friendly approach, and it was the right approach to take for our staff. So those were the first people we placed. And then within that, principals then had discussions with teachers if we needed teachers beyond that to find out who wanted to go in that direction. And we were able to place people that way.
The newspaper ran a story about a week ago that said that some teachers were describing the experience as being incredibly pressured, incredibly stressful. And I know you've indicated you are working to try to come up with some remedies for that. But what kinds of remedies are you talking about now? The teachers, some of them saying this is almost impossible to navigate.
And I think we are too. I don't think any of us are saying that this is the ideal situation or one that we even feel is something that's sustainable. But unfortunately, without being in a traditional mode of face-to-face instruction or the 100% remote where you have teachers assigned to that model, there is very little wiggle room that we really have. And so one of the things that makes it difficult is while we would love to give teachers Wednesdays off, we still have to meet the requirement by the end of the year for hours. And so that's the difficult part to try to find that balance. We did shorten the school day this year so that teachers had more time without students. And that took us really close to that 1080. So it's very hard for us to carve out any additional time. So some of the things that we've been trying to do is take away some of the requirements or restrictions that we had put in terms of having videos and lessons uploaded days in advance. Now teachers have an option to upload those or to record them while they're teaching live and then upload it afterwards. And then we've also put in some more programming things so that some of those lessons are taught already and teachers can upload that lesson already being taught. We have groups of teachers working together to share the load on that. But, you know, all of those things, all of the things we've done, we've taken away the requirement for conferences once a week and different things. But, you know, all of those are such small changes. And I hear teachers and they continue to say, we need time, we need time. And that is what in this model is so difficult, because we can't carve out the time because we're so close to that requirement. So we are looking at ways that we could maybe extend some time on the front end and the back end just to get us back to the normal schedule and then be able to give back like 3.5 hours on a Wednesday. And we're looking for opportunities. What will it look like when we come back? And how close are we to that point? So those are all things to continue, you know, to work on and monitor.
Well, let's talk about that since you brought that up. Yeah. How long do you anticipate, if you can anticipate, mm-hmm. being in the hybrid mode before you come back full time? Is there even a timetable for that?
Yeah, I think for our board, what we the school board has taken an approach where they adopted locally developed metrics. And so those metrics were created by myself in conjunction with medical experts and people in our medical field that we really felt confident about. And so they do have those. Those are not concrete, they're guidelines. And within that metric, it basically says that when we reach 5%, that's when we would come back to campus. And so 5% over a 14-day period. And then there's another factor in terms of the case count per day. And I would say case count and one other factor, absentee rate. And so I think today our 7-day average was at 4.9 maybe, or 4.7 roughly. Our 14-day was somewhere in the 6.3 or 8. So, you know, we're getting closer and closer to that point. That's why we're really beginning to have the discussions now, so that we would have a plan ready if we got to the place where the board said, yep, we're comfortable now. And especially with our early learners, those kids in elementary, we know that the data is showing that they need more frequently to be with their teacher. We can look at, maybe we bring kindergarten and first grade, or maybe we bring K-2 or K-5. So I've been working with superintendents throughout the metro area to really see what they've done and how those plans have worked out. You know, I continue to feel like Ames is a leader. We've taken an approach that's been keeping our teachers and our kids safe through this. Our data shows that we have very little spread. And so our approach to mitigation has worked. What we're doing is working for containing the spread. But on the academic side, we don't want to take that data and not be looking at that with the same level of integrity that we are the health data.
If you've just joined us, my name is Dennis Hart, and you're listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio here in Ames. And I'm talking today with Jenny Reisner, the superintendent of the Ames Community School District, about the challenges we're all facing, but particularly the school district, to get our way, make our way through the coronavirus pandemic. The percentages you were talking about, you're talking about the positivity rate of coronavirus testing.
Yes, I am. Yes.
Let's say you get down to below 5%. Do you see the board acting or the district acting quickly? Because those are, as you know, evanescent numbers that can change very, very fast. Would you move to bring kids back and then maybe in 2 weeks have to take them out again?
I sure hope not. We talk about this regularly. You know, there has to be that wiggle room there, because we know that from day to day, those numbers can fluctuate. We have been talking about those numbers and what it would look like, and watching, you know, really closely how big of a dip from day to day and what causes that dip. We know that Iowa State students are done in November around Thanksgiving time. And so it'll be interesting to see what our data does then. We do think there's an impact, obviously, when you have a college town. And so that might give us some breathing room. You know, to go back to the question you said around time frame, our middle and our high schools have unique challenges to bringing students back face-to-face that they would have to work through. It's much more difficult when you have kids in a class that goes a semester. You don't want to, in the middle of that semester, change modes, because that's going to be really difficult as we have to move some staffing around. So one of the thoughts that other districts are having is maybe we wait until semester. That gives teachers, administrators, parents plenty of time to plan, and then that plan is in place. But then, you know, the semester is right in the middle of cold and flu season. So you don't know. And with elementary, it's a little easier because those students are, for the most part, in one classroom. In talking with the principals, 2 weeks seems where we'd land with the elementaries.
So to clarify, if you do bring students back from the hybrid mode into full-time on-site teaching, would the fully online students now stay online for the rest of the year?
Absolutely. That opportunity will be there all year long. And so, you know, you guess, well, are there going to be parents that are going to choose, okay, now that you're back full time, we'll send our child back, or the opposite, now that you're back full time, we don't feel comfortable and we're glad this opportunity is there, we're going to take that opportunity. So the staffing becomes really challenging. You don't know until that time when you make the decision who's going to go which way.
Sounds very difficult. No question about this. For those who are in the hybrid mode and going to classes 2 or 3 days a week, what safety precautions have been put in place inside the schools, inside the classrooms, inside the hallways to make sure they're not exposed?
I'm so proud of our students and our parents for preparing their students to follow these mitigation steps, and our staff. We have required 100% masks for all students and all staff from day one, and we have had very little challenge to that. Students have been great, and as have our teachers and parents. Because we've been in this hybrid mode, we have been able to practice physical distancing, and that has kept our case count down. We only have 50% of 65% of our students who are attending face-to-face. We have about 35% in remote. So within that, you know, you take that group of 65% of our students and you break them in half, you're able to social distance. So with the masks, the social distancing, the practices that we're using at recess to have kids stay in their cohort group and social distance, all of those things have really obviously worked for us because our case counts are very, very small. And those are some of those things. We've amped up our cleaning. Our cleaning is extremely intense at night. There's practices in place for when kids come into class and leave class. We have sanitation going. Students have hand sanitizer that as they come in, they use hand sanitizer. As they leave, they use that sanitizer. So there's just a lot of practices in place. I guess another thing to mention, hallways. We have one-way hallways in our larger buildings. We have hallways that are just one way, so kids aren't passing. And then in our elementaries, we keep, you know, those classes aren't passing at the same time. So there's just a lot to all the logistics of that. But what we're seeing in terms of case count is that we definitely, our mitigation steps have worked.
What about lunch breaks? How is social distancing working there?
Mm-hmm. So for our elementary students, we have students eating in their classrooms with their cohort, and they are able to social distance. So they take their masks off, they're able to still social distance and eat. In the secondary, they have done a phenomenal job, those principals of planning. They've opened up additional areas and have supervision going on, and students, you know, they come in, they're social distance, and we know where they're sitting so that if there is any contact tracing that has to be done, we know who was sitting where. And that extended spacing of students has been possible because we're in that hybrid mode.
What's happened to physical education classes?
Well, the weather's been great. So a lot of those are outside. And then those teachers have come up with great plans as well. You know, some are doing more of a personal fitness approach. So there, again, because of the numbers, we're able to social distance and students do more of a personal approach. So those competition games where they're sharing balls and doing this and that, we just aren't doing those anymore. But yeah, they've done great. Our teachers are, you know, I say it again, our teachers are just phenomenal. We have excellent teachers.
How about school buses? How are you keeping them safe?
So we have a wonderful process in place. We are able to, so we're, students sit within their family. So if we have students who are sharing seats, it's usually with a family member or a student who is in their same core homeroom. And so that helps us with that contact tracing. Our buses are cleaned to the same level that we're cleaning our buildings, just, you know, really taking a lot of steps to make sure the cleaning efforts are there. Students get on, they sanitize. And so as they get on, they get their sanitizer and they, you know, they take care of that and they wear masks the whole time they're on the bus.
You've talked several times about the number of cases being relatively small. Can you give us some facts to back that one up? How many cases of infection have you had? How about quarantines?
So the tricky part on this is we are not able to say if it is under 5 or 6. If it's under 5 or 6 students, we're not able to say the exact number. But I can tell you enough to say that we are under 5. I think I'm supposed to say under 6, but we're under 5 and 4. So that narrows it down.
I mean, right now you are, right now.
So for students, yep, we sure are. And those are confirmed cases. And then for staff, we have 20 staff members who are self-quarantining due to exposure. Of those 20 staff members, 18 of those are due to exposure that's outside of the school.
With all of this going on now, how would you say that parents who have been buffeted as much as the students in every way on this, how have they reacted to what's been going on this semester?
Oh, yeah. You know, we have parents who are very concerned. They want their kids back in school. We have parents who are very concerned who don't want their kids back in school, who think, yes, I want to send my child, but not if you're not going to be able to social distance to the 6 feet. So we really have parents on both sides. And then we have parents who say, there's not a chance I'm sending my kid. We're going online. And those parents that reach out and that vocalize their concerns, you really empathize with them because this is a very difficult situation. It is hard on families. It's hard on our students and it's hard on our teachers. And so, you know, you hear that concern. I said it earlier, you know, the parent who's, I'm trying to support my family. I'm working. I have multiple students who I'm trying to educate when I come home. And it's a big load for parents. And then the other side of parents who say, you know, I want my child to be able to come to school and socialize and have that face-to-face interaction, but I need for you to keep it at, you know, the 50% so they can social distance. And so we really do have both sets of parents, and I know it's a burden.
I asked you this a few weeks ago. Given that none of us alive have ever gone through what we're going through now, what you're going through right now, no one has gone through this in 100 years or so. How would you describe how hard this is and has been for you professionally and personally?
Mm-hmm. I would say this is without a doubt the most challenging thing that I have ever experienced in my career. There is nothing that even compares to this. We are trying to redefine education in a few months, really. You think we've only been doing this since March. And you know, the history of education, as you look at it, is so entrenched in practices and processes that have been around forever. So for anyone to think that this is any less than difficult, you know, they would be mistaken. It is an absolutely challenging time. And my job is amazing because I get to watch these phenomenal educators do their work every day for our students. But the best part is the students, and not having the ability to see students every single day, all of our students, is hard. On a personal level, you know, I went into education because my passion is for students. I was a teacher. I come from a family of educators, and my heart is for kids. And so my fear of what's going on outside of school and the amount that our kids might be losing on a day-to-day basis, it weighs on me every single day. And so that's tough.
I also asked you this a few weeks ago, given that the decisions you and the district are making about kids and the mode of education, knowing that the decisions you make literally might mean life or death, that has to be incredibly difficult for you.
It is. Boy, there's a lot of sleepless nights. A lot of sleepless nights. These are day-to-day decisions that we have just, as educators, never had to make. And when I say educators, I guess it does go to the teacher level, but as superintendents, boy, it is a tough job right now. And it is one that in communities, you have 50% that agree with this and 50% that agree with that, and you're not going to make everybody happy and trying to keep kids first, but then also knowing that we can be putting lives in jeopardy for our adults. Finding that balance is something that it just doesn't leave your mind. There's not a day that goes by. There's not even a half hour that I'm not thinking about, what do we do here? What do we do there? Are we sure we're doing this? And it's a trying time.
What would you like to say to the Ames community?
You know, first and foremost, this has been an incredibly supportive community. I have listened to superintendents across the nation talk about the resistance to wearing masks, resistance to social distancing. And I just think, wow, I am blessed with this community. They are incredibly supportive. And I want our community to know, I know how much you want to have your kids back in school. And those of you that are remote, I know that you appreciate that option being there. And so we are all doing everything we can to try and meet the needs. And we will continue to do that. And the other thing I would say is I do welcome communications. So you are absolutely welcome to email me and I will get back to you. Sometimes it takes a day or two, but I do want to hear from you, and I appreciate the conversations that we've had.
All right. I just want to thank you so much for being with us today.
Yes. Thank you so much for the opportunity. I just really appreciate it.
This is Dennis Hart. My guest has been Jenny Reisner, the superintendent of the Ames Community School District, talking about the challenges the district is facing with the coronavirus and the new methods of teaching that have had to be created almost on the spot. Our thanks to Jenny Reisner for joining us today.
You're listening to KHOI Community Radio on Local Talk, our COVID-19 response. And I'm Pat Schlarbaum. Anna Medana Magnuson, are you in the house?
Yeah, thank you, Pat. So today's heart-to-heart message is inspired by yesterday's snowfall, which I give a big thumbs down because I think it's a sign that I need to stop up on hot cocoa for this winter 2020. And it's also brought to you by Melissa's heart-to-heart messages from her Random Acts of Kindness book. So this one is titled The Winter's Coat. A friend of mine was going back east to college. Not only was it going to be her first time away from home, but even more overwhelmingly to a California baby, she was going to experience her first true winter. She spent months looking for the perfect winter coat, a task all the more difficult when even long pants seem stifling. Finally, 2 days before her departure, she found a coat that would keep her from getting frostbite and maybe even homesick. Unfortunately, the store didn't have the size she needed, but another location 30 miles away did. In desperation, she told the saleswoman her situation, and the saleswoman consoled her, promising that she would take care of it. 2 days and a few logistical phone calls later, the saleswoman met my friend at the airport gate, perfect fitting coat in hand. The saleswoman was definitely acting above and beyond the call of duty, since I'm sure her job description didn't require her to deal with airport parking. So as we all pray for winter 2020, I'm sending out the wish for lots of warmer weathers, warm mittens, and scarves. But also, it's Tune In Tuesday as I try and tempt you to listen to the Heart to Heart Messages program by reading the lyrics of the song I've matched the guest and their messages tonight. See if you can guess the song I selected and find out if you're right by tuning in tonight at KHOI 89.1 FM at 8:30 p.m. So who will our guests be tonight? Meridu Joseph, Mark Munn, Alicia Wilkinson, and Miriam Martinsik. What do they have in all common? They're all artists who will be coming to talk with me about their art and about their lives as artists. Now, they were scheduled to be on the program on August 11th, but at the 11th hour, you might remember we had to cancel because we had a derecho storm that day. But I'm so glad they have decided to come back and join me once again. It's almost been 2 months later. So here are the songs I have matched to their heart-to-heart messages. For Miriam's message about dogs and art, and to all those who love and walk dogs and are inspired by dogs, I dedicate these lyrics to you. I love my dog as much as I love you. But you may fade, my dog will always come through. All he asks for me is a food to give him strength. All he ever needs is love and that he knows he'll get. So that is for Miriam's message. Can you guess what song that is, anybody? So you'll have to find out tonight. For Mark and to all those who want storytelling images that help us remember people and moments, these lyrics are for you. Awake on my airplane, awake on my airplane. I feel so real. Could you want to take my picture? Because I won't remember. Could you want to take my picture? Because I won't remember. It's a good tune. I've been listening to it about 3 times after I downloaded it. I like it. So for Alicia and to all those who inspiration comes from the creator as they process through the deep pain and incredible joys in life, alongside the desire to bring transformation to other people's lives, I dedicate these lyrics to you. Your hands that shape the world are holding me. They hold me still when my hand is shaking, the world is shaking. When my heart is breaking, I never leave you. Now, the next song, we're totally going to rock out and have a Zoom dance party. So this is for Meridu and for those of you who won't ever stop believing in themselves and dreams and artists and art. And in whatever makes us believe in each other, I dedicate these lyrics to you. Don't stop believing. Hold on to that feeling. Streetlight people, don't stop believing. Hold on. Okay, now that is a butchered song, but you can kind of guess what it is, maybe, but probably not from that bad singing. So I hope you tune in tonight at KHOI 89.1 FM to listen to these artists and the songs that I pick. So thank you for listening to these individual heart-to-heart messages that connect us to a community of love, care, and support. So back to you, Pat.
Thank you so much, Anna Banana. Would you like to just go ahead and close us out, please?
Of course. Our theme song, as always, is Backtracking by Tom Richards and Al Harris from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. Remember, you, the listener, are what makes KHOI meaningful and possible. Thank you to Pat. Thank you to Mike Murphy. Thank you for listening. Thank you for supporting KHOI. And we'll see you again on the radio.
Were you convicted of a felony? Would you like to vote in Iowa? Now you probably can. On August 5th, the law in Iowa changed. That means most Iowans convicted of a felony can now vote. As long as you've discharged your sentence, including probation, parole, supervised release, and special sentence. Find out more at youcanvoteiowa.org. That's youcanvoteiowa.org.
This is KHOI, Story City AIM.